and after the act of remembrance. If we can have my PowerPoint on the screen, that'd be great. And I want to look at four key elements of the Christian story of the world. In the first half, we're going to look at creation and fall. And in the second half, we're going to look at redemption or rescue and restoration. Restoration is how, in the end, God will put the world right. And I hope as we go through that we'll see that we need the Christian story to make sense of who we are. It explains who human beings are and what's gone wrong with us and how to put it right in a way that I don't think any other worldview does. And it makes sense of our experience of remembrance. Let's ask ourselves why we remember. Why do we wear poppies and observe the silence? I guess the answer would be something like we remember because people matter. Every person matters. Stalin said that one death is a tragedy, but a million deaths are a statistic. But on Remembrance Sunday, we say every one of those millions of deaths was not just a statistic, it mattered. Every name on this war memorial matters. One of the things that made the poppies at the Tower of London so powerful last year was that each one was handmade, and they were exactly the right number for the people who died in the forces. And it was saying in a very powerful way that every single person was unique and irreplaceable. And it's exactly that that we'll be saying tonight when people come to our bereavement service to mourn those who they've lost. Every one of them was irreplaceable, and the world is not the same without each of them. And Christianity says that's because each of us is created in the image of God. The climax of creation, which we heard read in Genesis chapter 1, is human beings made in the image of God. They're made on the same day as the animals, out of the same stuff as the animals, but then different radically from the animals because they're made in God's image. And so they reflect something of God himself. And every human being does that. It doesn't matter how old or young, rich or poor, clever or not so clever, every human being images or reflects God. God created man in his own image, male and female, he created them. And therefore, human beings are equally precious regardless of their position or power in the world. Now, let's not kid ourselves that we would have come to that conclusion without our Christian heritage. Aristotle, perhaps the greatest philosopher ever, said that certain groups of people were born to be slaves. The ancient Babylonian code of Hammurabi divided people into three categories: superior people, commoners, and slaves. Hinduism says that cosmic forces have created four castes, and below them are outcasts, and nothing can change that basic pattern of creation. But Christianity says no, every human being is equal because every human being is made in God's image. I don't know how many of you read this book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. It's been a bestseller recently. It's written by an Israeli academic called Yuval Harari. I think it's a brilliant book, though it's quite anti-Christian. But he does recognize where human rights come from. He quotes the most famous sentence in the American Declaration of Independence, and this is his emphasis. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Well, he says, hang on. According to the science of biology, people were not created, but evolved. And they certainly did not evolve to be equal. The Americans got that from the Christian idea of creation. Yes, exactly. However, he says, if we do not believe Christian myths, we have to recognize that evolution is based on difference, not equality. Different qualities carry with them different chances of survival. Endowed by their creator should simply be translated born, and there are no unalienable rights, just mutable characteristics. So this is how he says it should now be translated. He says there's also no such thing as liberty or happiness in biology, just blind evolutionary process. So today we must translate it as we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men have evolved differently, that they are born with certain mutable characteristics, and that among these are life and the pursuit of pleasure. Well, that's the contemporary non-Christian worldview, isn't it? Later in the book, he points out that Hitler's ideas were based on the superiority of one race or group of people over another. And he says, therefore, for 60 years, it has been taboo to point out that this is the implication of evolutionary humanism. But now, he says, a huge gulf is opening up between our liberal political beliefs in equality, on the one hand, and our scientific understanding of biology, on the other, a gulf which we cannot ignore much longer. He's saying that we might want to believe in equality and human rights, but without the Christian idea of creation beneath them, it is unsustainable in the long term. It's because of Christianity that we believe every human being matters equally. So now let's go on to the second part of the Christian story, the fall. And this part of the story argues that God gave us a unique responsibility to rule over his world for him, but we rebelled, we pushed him out. We refused to live within the limits he gave us, and we declared independence. We all, like sheep, have gone astray, turned each one to his own way. And that rebellion has affected all of us and all of the world. So if you want to get a grasp on humanity, then you have to both get a grasp on creation and on fall and hold them together. In the Narnia books, Prince Caspian discovers he's descended from pirates, and he wishes he came from a more noble background. And Aslan, or Jesus, says this to him: "You come from the Lord Adam and the Lady Eve. That is both honor enough to erect the head of the poorest beggar and shame enough to bow the head of the greatest emperor on earth. Be content." Creation and fall, honor and shame. It is a great glory to be made in the image of God, but it's a great shame to be a rebel who's pushed God out and tried to live without him. And that is why human history is so violent, with war after war. Will Rogers, an American comedian, said, "You can't say civilization is not advancing. In every war, they kill you in a new way." When anthropologists study simple societies, they don't find peace and harmony. They find conflict, violence deeply ingrained in the way that people react to one another. And a typical figure, according to Harari, is that about 25% of male deaths are caused by violence. In New Guinea today, there's one tribe, the Danai, where 30% of male deaths are caused by violence. In another tribe, the Enga, the figure is 35%. That's why peace is a modern invention and war is as old as mankind. We're fallen creatures. We can't get on with each other. And that's why wars happen. It's why we fall out with our colleagues at work. It's why so many marriages fail. It's why the largest car maker in Europe is cheating on its tests, and why the organization that exists to promote the beautiful game is riddled with corruption. Richie Beno said, "I only have one rule about gambling. Never bet on anything that can talk." That's the problem, isn't it? Things that can talk. So we human beings are both made in the image of God. We have a tremendous instinct for love and justice and kindness and truth. But we're also fallen creatures, rebels who push God out and fight and blame each other. Now I'm going to stop there because we're going to move towards our silence, and we'll go on with the story in a few moments after 11 o'clock. Second reading shortly. Listen to me, I haven't quite got to the end of four. So it's talking about how we're both made in the image of God and fallen creatures, And Dorothy L. Sayers wrote this some years ago, but it still rings true. She said, "For the last 200 years or so, we've been trying to persuade ourselves that there's no such thing as sinfulness. Nothing inherently unsatisfactory about man as such. But isn't there? I feel sorry for the humanists," she said. "They trusted in man so blindly, and now they're bewildered by the present condition of the world. All this science and..." My printer stopped working at this point, so I have to put my glasses on to read it. "All this science and education and tolerance and enlightenment results not in peace and progress, but in frustration and reactionary violence. Increased science and power have not altered man's nature, but only enlarged the scope and opportunity for good and evil." One of the things that I've been reflecting on, having come back from China, is why are people so open to the gospel in China in comparison to here? And I think the reason, one of the reasons, must be that they've lost their faith in humanity. They've seen the terrible things that have happened in China over the last 50 or 100 years, and they know that human beings can't be trusted. Their faith in humanity has been completely destroyed by what they've been through, and so they know they have to look to another power. Whereas here we think we're basically not too bad. But Christianity says we must face reality. Remembrance Sunday is a day when we have to face the uncomfortable truth about ourselves. These wars are our fault, and the injustice in the world today is our fault. And the problem is humanity, and more education or science or prosperity is not going to fix it. So how does God put it right? Where does redemption or rescue come from? Eddie Izzard has a simple answer. He said, "If God existed, he would afflict Hitler's head off." That's all you have to do. If only Eddie Izzard was in charge of the world, everything would be fine. But maybe, Eddie, it's not that simple. So we're going to hear our next two readings from Al. Thanks, Al. "So just flick Hitler's head off," says Eddie Izzard. And we know the world works through power and strength, don't we? The most powerful wins. God is the most powerful, so just flick his head off. Sorry about these sound things. I'm not doing anything to cause it, I promise you. Well, the Bible story shows us a very different way from power and strength as the answer. And I want to give you a couple of examples that might not be so obvious. Think about who God chooses to work through in the Old Testament. The ancient world was dominated by the iron law of primogeniture. In other words, everything went to the oldest son. And that was how families preserved their power and position. But who does God choose? Again and again, not the oldest, but the youngest. Abel over Cain, Isaac over Ishmael, Jacob over Esau, David over all seven of his older brothers. That's telling us something. God doesn't work in the way the world expects. Or think about women. In that world, women who had lots of children were heroic, because that was how you ensured economic and military success, how you guaranteed your family's prosperity. So who does God choose? Again and again, the women who can't have children. Sarah, Abraham's wife, Rebecca, Isaac's wife, Samuel's mother Hannah, Elizabeth, John the Baptist's mother. God works through the men and women that nobody wanted, the younger sons, the childless women. And the nation he chooses is not one of the big empires, Rome or Babylon or Egypt, but Israel, a tiny little group of people who spend their time being kicked around by the big powers of the time. And when God finally comes, he comes as a baby in a food trough with two peasants as parents, weak and lowly. God is not going to save the world through power. So flicking Hitler's head off is not the answer, Eddie. Prince Talleyrand was a French general and statesman who had a chameleon-like career. He started under Louis XVI, but then he switched sides to serve the revolutionary forces, and then he switched side again to serve Napoleon. And he summed up his years of experience in government like this. It's not fireworks. He said, "You can do many things with bayonets, but it is rather uncomfortable to sit on them." Now, you have to think about what that means, don't you? He's saying that sometimes you have to fight. You have to use force when evil attacks. You can't just surrender. You have to fight back. And so we give thanks today from our hearts for those who fought for their country and still do. I don't believe that Christians should be pacifists. But in the end, force is not the answer. You can't win hearts and minds through force. And so God saves the world through weakness, through, in the end, the ultimate weakness, death on a cross. And so on Remembrance Sunday, we give thanks for the military, but we also know that military power is not the real answer. Laurie, if you bring me a radio mic, I'll switch and see if that stops that noise. Okay, so we've looked at creation and fall and redemption. But that's not the end of the story. Oh, thanks, Liz. So let's see if this is any better. The last section is restoration. God has promised that one day, as we heard in that reading from Revelation, he will put the world right. So the Christian story has a beginning and a middle, but also an end. We know where the world's going. We're heading somewhere. We're given a glorious vision of the future. And that's what gives us hope and keeps us going. A time, as we heard in that reading, when God will wipe away every tear, when there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. So Christians do claim to have an answer to the big questions. What is the point of life? Where are we going? How can I play a part in putting the world right? We do claim to have answers to those questions. Now, some people say we don't need answers to them. They say there isn't any grand scheme in the world. Just live for today and make the best of it. Don't worry about what happens when you die, because you won't be there anyway. A French philosopher called Luc Ferry, who's not a Christian, says those kind of statements are too brutal to be honest. Too brutal to be honest, he says. People who make them can't really believe them, because we cannot live without hope or meaning. We need a sense that some actions matter more than others. And only that will make us really capable of joy, generosity, and love. I think that's true, isn't it? Doesn't that resonate with our experience? We need to know where we're going and what we're here for. Someone pointed out something that I hadn't noticed about the self-help books that crowd our bookshelves. Not our bookshelves, but the bookshop bookshelves. They're not on my bookshelf, I promise you. But they offer to help us with stress and anxiety and unhappiness. But he pointed out they never address the big questions, the real questions. What are we here for? Where are we going? Instead, they tell you to sit on the beach and contemplate the surf and live in the moment. And the reason they don't ask the questions is, of course, because our culture doesn't have an answer. So just focus on the waves and don't think about them, don't think about death. But what that leaves us with is a great sense of emptiness, a strange melancholy. Because we can't live just for ourselves. We can't live just in the moment. And we're left with a sort of ache for meaning inside if we just try and live for today. Because we need something to live for that's bigger than ourselves. Christianity says there is meaning in the universe, infinite meaning. And so every step of courage, every word of truth, every act of mercy matters. Even a cup of water you give someone, Jesus says, matters in eternity. And unless we believe that, why bother? So Christians believe that we're heading somewhere, that God is in charge of the world, and one day he will make it right. And this is what we believe. Just think about this. Our bad things, our suffering, will turn out for good. Our good things cannot be taken from us. and the best things are yet to be. Just think about it, what difference it makes to your life if you come to know that those things are true. And the strength it gives you to bear the suffering and struggle in the world. So what I'm suggesting to you on Remembrance Sunday is that every stage of the Christian story is needed to make sense of our lives and of the emotions that we experience today. Creation. Every human being is made in the image of God. That's why we matter. That's why we remember each of them. Evolutionary biology, the survival of the fittest, is not the real story or the final story. Fall. At the heart of the problem is us. It is deep in us and it affects everything. And that's why war is such an inescapable part of human experience. Redemption, that power is not the answer. God works through weakness and suffering. And so don't ever believe that military power can be the final solution. And then restoration, the sure and certain hope of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, keeps us going and working for truth and justice and peace. Never give up, because even the smallest act of courage and mercy matters in eternity. So let's just pray together. Lord, we thank you for your work in the world. Thank you that you didn't come in power to destroy us, but in weakness and gentleness to find us and bring us home. And we pray that we might open our hearts to you, that we might come back to you, and that as we do, you might take us and use us to serve your world and to bring peace and justice and to care for those in need. Amen.